I heard testimony earlier this morning, and again, I'm not an attorney, that with respect to judicial immunity for court appointees, there may be a difference of opinion in the appeals courts out of Harris County and Bexar County. With respect to answering that question, I think that's a critical question as a matter of public policy. In one case, the Conte case, the trustee who managed to take that trust from a very solvent, probably $7 or $8 million trust with $3 million in the bank and $500,000 a year income down to no money in the bank, no income, and probably about only two-thirds of the value of the estate. I think somebody should have the right to go back and challenge the $1.5 million that that person received as they were allegedly being a fiduciary. I don't think that there should be any immunity granted, but that's a public policy question. I would urge you not to. Allow them to go through the judicial system, same as everybody else has to, and determine the question whether or not they exercise their fiduciary duties and responsibilities consistent with the best interest, consistent with how a prudent person would manage their own affairs. And I don't think prudent people sue themselves too often. Maybe they do. And consistent with the best interest of the beneficiaries, and let that be challenged in court. That's my recommendation to the committee, Mr. Chairman, on judicial immunity. Throughout my investigation of probate court over the years, I heard time and time again, and it's not written any place, it's simply an attitude, that when somebody has a contested case brought to the probate court for help, and I think that's the intent of the legislature, is that the probate court is to help the families resolve problems. But when they do, the attitude I've been given is that the property, the estate, the assets, then belong solely to the court. Not until the court makes a final distribution of it do they belong to anybody else. Well, I think, again, as a matter of public policy, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't belong to the court. It belongs to the heirs, whether or not they're known. It belongs to the beneficiaries. It belongs to the ward. And it's only under the care and safekeeping of the court until it is distributed, not the property of theirs to do with as they want. That's an attitude I get. And, Mr. Chairman, I agree that we have a very good probate law from everything I see. I'm not here to propose big changes in the probate law. I think it's the application of it, which begins back with behavior by the participants in it. One thing I
well,
would...
Well, that's the challenge and difficulty we face, because I would like to correct some of what I perceive to be abuses of the system. And I'm not entirely sure that that we're going to be able to do as much as I would like to do legislatively. It's sort of like a lot of the societal problems we face. In public education. I mean, there are some things that are beyond our ability to change. So some of these things that are societal problems really begin with the family, and we can't pass enough laws to correct those. But whatever we can do, I, for one, want to do. So I appreciate the recommendations you've made thus far.
Mr. Chairman, just to sort of finish up, there's one area that's always bothered me in investigating these, and that's the sale of property out of the probate estates. And when it is sold to a partnership or a trust of some sort, I believe that since these are being sold out of the court on behalf of an estate, a beneficiary, a trustee, an heir, a ward, that as a matter of public policy, you may want to require full disclosure of all financially interested people within that organization that's buying it. I think it's a matter of sunshine. It's a matter of integrity to give the families confidence that their properties aren't being sold below market value to somebody that's turning around and flipping them for major profits.
Good point.
And again, it's just simply a matter of full disclosure. I think that based on the 4.5 years that I spent with Judicial Watch here in Texas, talking to families all across the country, all across the state, mothers who spend month after month after month trying to get a distribution out of a trust fund for their incapacitated child, while that very same attorney handling that account gets paid from the court in 30 days upon application, I've heard all of the frustrations. I've heard all the aggravations. And I believe that there's some public exposure needed. I believe there's oversight needed, simply same as this legislative body provides oversight in the executive branch. It should do it on the judicial branch. I believe that this is not a Harris County problem. This is not a Judge Wood problem. This is not a statutory probate court problem. This is a Texas problem, from the Valley to Amarillo and from El Paso to Texarkana. The problems are the same, whether it's the $120,000 house that's the only part of an estate, or if it's the multi-million, $100 million estates that are being litigated in the courts. The end results to the families are, and my advice to them is, if you have to go to probate court, hold your wallet, because it's going out the door. Don't go to probate court under any condition in the state of Texas if you want to see your finances come out in a contested matter. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that in some instances, there, in my opinion, there's ongoing criminal enterprises here. I would love to see the legislature in the next session convene a special investigative body to look into not just the four or five that came up here today, but the hundreds of cases that would like to tell you about what happened to them. Absent that, Mr. Chairman, or in addition to that, I would think that it would be appropriate public policy for you to look at the creation, not of an ombudsman, but of an inspector general in the judicial branch. In the last session of the United States Congress, in both the House and the Senate, there was a bill introduced in each to create such a position as an inspector general, where some of these questions can be aired out with the inspector general. Now, what's the distinction between an inspector general versus a judicial conduct commission? I filed several, if not many, complaints with the Judicial Conduct Commission over the last 4.5 years. And a consistent answer from them is that if the event occurred within the four walls of a courtroom, if it occurred within the four walls of a courtroom, it's a matter subject to appeal and not a matter of conduct. The Judicial Conduct Commission looks
That's not accurate.
It may not be accurate, Mr. Chairman, but that is certainly what I've been told.
We've had judges removed from office for conduct in the courthouses where they conduct business. I think of one in South Texas in particular. Improper relationships with employees and litigants in his court.
I'm sorry, I wasn't.
He's no longer a judge.
I'm familiar with the case. I wasn't clear, Mr. Chairman. If it happens within the four walls of the courtroom where a trial is going on, like in the case of Mr. Alpert, where things were said to him by a judge, it is not a subject matter for the Judicial Conduct Commission. It's a subject matter for the appellate process. It could be reviewed on appeal, but not through the Judicial Conduct Commission. But things that happen outside of a trial are behavioral items which the Judicial Conduct Commission in its infinite wisdom will take a look at and bury. And that, Mr. Chairman, I believe are all of the recommendations that I have. I believe it is truly a cottage industry that has sprung up around this specialized court. I think there are some very good judges, very good attorneys, very good litigants throughout the process, and I think there are some very bad ones. And the job is to ferret them out. It's more a matter of behavior than it is a matter of legislation, unfortunately.
Yeah. I appreciate your testimony and your suggestions, and we've taken note of them. I have a very competent lawyer back here who's not going to be with us that much longer, but she's taking great notes, and we'll be working on these suggestions.
May I inquire, is that Mrs. Calcote?
It is Ms. Calcote,
well,
yes.
Well, I tell you, there's a whole community out here who would be very, very sad to see Mrs. Calcote leave this position.
Well, Ms. Calcote's been with me for the better part of a decade, and she has a little girl that needs her attention at home more, she claims, than her professional services to the people of Texas. So we're all going to miss her.
On behalf of many of the families throughout the state of Texas who are afraid to come to a hearing like this for fear of retribution in their cases, I'd like to thank not only the chairman and the members of the committee and the staff for this, but especially Mrs. Calcote for all she's done to allow these people to have a voice. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Thank you, sir. Chairman. Okay, we understand Mr. Ragland is here but doesn't wish to testify. Is that correct? All right. Chair calls Van Brookshire.
We might have to hire a trustee to keep Ms. Calcote.
Yeah, we might. We might. You'd identify yourself and who you represent and proceed, please, sir.
Yes, sir. My name is Van Brookshire. I represent myself. I, too, have a story about probate court, and it happens to be in Harris County, probate court number one, and it is still in process. I have been given a crash course on probate court and what it means in Harris County the last 5 months because of this case that involves my mom. I was oblivious to the whole structure of probate court and what it has, what it can do to you, and the powers that these judges seem to have. There are a lot of reasons why these cases are here today and what we're hearing. You know, there's conflict in families, there's control, there's revenge. Whatever the reason, we end up in probate court. And the person in my case is my mom, who is very, very dear to me. And so I'm willing to stand here today and face possible retribution from a judge who has verbally threatened me on three separate occasions to drop my contest in this case, because I believe that we all in this room need to stand up for what's right. My story is too long to tell because we've heard it before. There's abuses of the system. These people in these specialty courts, they truly have a probate business. They are running it for profit. And it profits their small group, their small circle. When I was drawn into this, I went to my family attorney, a friend for over 35 years, and he told me there's no way to win. There's not enough money in the world. You cannot go to Harris County and survive this. Kiss it all goodbye and lick your wounds and walk away. I went to five additional attorneys, some of them within this circle, this small club. They either wanted too much money, or they didn't have time, or they didn't want to go into that particular judge's court for whatever reason. I learned that this circle of friends has a name in Harris County. It's called the Tomb Raiders Club, and they pride themselves on making a living out of this particular industry that they have created. They have a list of appointees that we've heard all these people talk about. You listen to these names, you hear the same names over and over again. You start researching this court, which I have done thanks to the internet, you see it's the same people that get the good, nice estates and get to be appointed on those estates. I could continue on and complain about what has happened to my family, and it's not going to accomplish anything. You gentlemen are charged with something this year that I don't think can be done in a year. You need to change this. You need to put some teeth in it. I have three recommendations for a cure. And my recommendations may seem extreme, but we have a situation out there, sounds like all over the state, that is extreme. Now, it's only affecting a small group of people as far as out of the whole population of this state. There are very few people being drawn into this and being victimized by it. But a way to stop it is to take away unlimited access to money and these courts' abilities to seize assets. Stop them from spending the victim or the mark's money. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to change the code to stop that. But if you stop that, you take away the reason why this is happening, and that's this dollar bill right here. The second thing that needs to happen that can also do this is to eliminate these specialty courts. Do away with this circle of friends, these little kingdoms. Put everybody on an equal playing field, back in district court or county courts. Don't give these guys their own little ballpark to play in, because they will change the rules to meet their needs. The third thing, we've heard about Judicial Ethics Commission. Give these men some teeth. Give this commission some teeth to go after these judges, even if they are not doing something improper, which many of them may not be, but they sure look like they are. And the vision from the outside is that there is some kind of impropriety going on. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for spending the time and staying here this afternoon. And I hope that you have good luck in your endeavor. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Mr. Brookshire. Thank you for being here. Chair calls Joseph Conti.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the Senate giving us an opportunity to speak here today. I'll try to be brief and address some of the issues that you requested in regard to proposed legislation. I'm not going to repeat a lot of things that my sister said, and Mr. Verney covered a majority of the operations we have in Houston, but I'd like to give a brief background on my father and then go into proposed changes I recommend. My father was a Chevrolet dealer in Houston for over 20 years. We're the second largest Chevrolet dealership in the United States. He invested a lot of his income into commercial real estate property in Houston and New Orleans. And in 1972, we opened up a Toyota dealership in New Orleans, where he was from originally. And our background is with Chevrolet Motor Division, General Motors, Toyota, and our own commercial real estate developments that we purchased and executed long-term leases with. Two of the properties involved in Houston were with Harris County. We had our building that my father owned, which was into the trust that he established, on Old Spanish Trail in Greenbrier, which was leased to the Justice of the Peace and the Mosquito Control Laboratory. Also, my father owned bought the Jacoby Pearson Ford dealership downtown Houston in the late 70s or sometime during the 70s. And in 1982, to diversify his assets to his family, he had established a corporation in 1969 for my sister and myself. I borrowed $1 million from the corporation and purchased a property on 1404 Leland downtown. And that was a full square block, which the dealership facility was located for the Ford dealership. It has about 45,000 square feet. That property we had leased from 1993 to 2003 with the Harris County Probation Department and Vehicle Maintenance. Approximately 1993, my father passed away. But before he died, he had established an irrevocable trust that upon his death becomes irrevocable. He had a will, and everything was established, where upon his death, my sister, my mother, and myself would be co-trustees with unanimous consent to run the trust. In 1998, we appointed Paul Miller at the recommendation of my attorney to do an accounting, and her term was to be 2 6-month terms to do an accounting for the trust. And my sister and I appointed her. My mother at that time was incapacitated and was not involved in a co-trustee capacity. Shortly after that appointment, I provided Ms. Miller, Paula Miller, who was the temporary trustee we appointed in Judge Austin's court, Probate Court 1, all the information that my father and I had been dealing with before his death, things that I've been dealing with to manage the operations for our commercial real estate developments and other actions involving our corporation. And I went over everything with her in detail. I provided her over 20,000 documents to bring her up to speed on everything it's handling, to look at the overall picture financially of our operations. Within approximately a year after that, I started getting contacts by her in regarding the 1646 Old Spanish Trail building that we had. I mentioned at Old Spanish Trail in Greenbrier, which is in the Houston Medical Center. My father owned that property for over 20 years, and it was leased to Harris County for 20 years, generating approximately $350,000 a year or $30,000 a month rent from the county lease. Shortly after that, I received notice that Ms. Miller wanted to sell the property because the lease had expired in 1999 with the county. And I told her, we're not selling the property. My sister agreed, and then I told her we're going to have to release the property. She started telling me where we're going to sell it, that the building is condemned, it's not habitable, and that we're just going to go ahead and sell it. And I said, we're not authorizing you to do so. So without my authorization or approval, she instituted proceedings to sell the property and not release it for lease. And again, these properties are unencumbered. They've been in our property for many years. And when Ms. Miller was appointed, we had approximately $2.5 million cash in the bank in U.S. Treasury bond accounts with Nations Bank. And we had approximately $500,000 a year income, $30,000 a month coming in on this building with the county. And also we had the interest income from the $2.5 million in the bank. There was absolutely no debt in the corporation, I mean the trust, and there was absolutely no reason to do this. But without my understanding, she had billed, you know, approximately $20,000 a month. And I filed a notice in the court and also Ms. Miller and all the parties involved that I'm not authorizing any of their actions and I want them to cease and desist. And they'd ignored my notice to the court, filed and stamped, and they proceeded to sell the property for approximately $2 million. And based on an income approach alone with approximately $400,000 a year income coming in, the property is worth about $4 million. It's in the Houston Medical Center right next to a $600 million development expansion. And the property was sold for $2 million approximately.
To whom did they sell the property?
Well, this is interesting. The original notice of sale was to, I believe, it was called Medical Center Real Estate, and which is really bizarre to me, but it was signed by Bob Ramdahl's president, Gibraltar Financial Group. And they mentioned, they were the ones who proposed the offer to buy it. The day before, shortly before the sale, it appears that the property was not Medical Center Realty and Gibraltar Financial, but the Women's Hospital, which was next door to the property. So, without my authorization, the property was sold. $2 million, I think it was sold for approximately $2,246,000. But after all the attorney's fees and real estate commissions, it was $2 million left over. This not only cost us the over approximately $2 million equity in the property, but we no longer enjoyed $30,000 a month that we've been receiving for over 20 years, and this property was unencumbered. Then, after this, I receive a notice that Ms. Miller says that the 1404 Leland building, which I had signed a promissory note, security agreement, deed of trust with my father, buying it for the corporation, County Investments, for $1 million in 1982, she stated that there was a mention in the tax return that that property was the trust property, not County Investments, which purchased it in 1982. I told her that my dad had set up a trust, and during the trust, it was in the asset of the trust, but in 1982, he sold it to County Investments. I provided her, she had access to the deed of trust, security agreement, everything filed with the court, the clerk's office, showing that County Investments owned the property. I get another letter stating that the trust owns the property. Then I wrote her a letter, and so did my sister's attorney, outlining the history of the trust. It was in the trust, it was sold to County Investments. $1 million was paid, and then she keeps reiterating that the property is a trust property after she has copies of the deed of trust security agreement. Then I receive a letter where she acknowledges that the last chain of title is in the County Investments, but that we want you to sign a deed of trust and security agreement transferring the property to the trust to clear up any title discrepancy. I refuse to do so. Then she notifies me that Harris County, which was a tenant in the property that we had at least till 2003, and this was approximately 2000, and said that they had left the building and they're no longer a tenant. I told her we have a lease with the county. We'd like to look into honoring that. In the meantime, I contacted Grubb and Ellis and Cushman Wakefield, two of the major commercial real estate developers in the United States, to look at this for me. I got a letter from both of them stating that they could list it for lease for $1 a square foot, triple net as is, with some minor landscaping modifications to the building, which would generate about $40,000 a month. And this was in 1999-2000. Ms. Miller attempted to tell me that they're not gonna honor that, they wanna sell the property. And I get a letter that states that we got a buyer for the property for $1,400,000. This property is a one entire square block, free and clear, unencumbered, except we had $1 million loan to the trust, which the trust had bought. The note was approximately $10,000 a month, and the lease from the county, which was $16,000 a month, was more enough to pay the $10,000 a month. She interfered with my attempts to lease the property. I could not lease the property, and they attempted to state now we're in default of the lease, I mean the note, and we're going to foreclose on the property, and we're going to allow this person to bid at the foreclosure sale. I provide Judge Austin the deed of trust, security agreement, the letters from Ms. Miller on one hand billing large amounts of money stating the trust owns it, then a letter from her billing lots of money stating trust doesn't own it, County Investments owns it, and the fact that she wants to sell it to a third party, and the sole reason in one of her notices is to pay the fees to administer the trust. So basically, based on my latest report here, I just updated from the probate court records and two dockets involved. As of today, approximately $2,798,000 in fees have been paid to Paula Miller and her associates and third parties involving in this court. Paula Miller alone received $1,385,000. The judge ignored this information, and I felt that he had some bias and prejudice in regard to this matter. This went on for a few years. We objected to the sale of this 1404 Leland property. My sister joined me with that, and the judge backed off in any motion to sell the property at that time. Then this kept going on and on. About three attempts that were pursued by her to sell the property to one person, then another. And her actions continued with the judge's actions by ignoring the truth and the facts and the law in this matter, and the fact that we entrusted them to manage our stuff a short period of time to do an accounting. I looked into the fact that there's some kind of conflict of interest here. I checked the Beverly Kaufman has a search engine on her clerk's site, which Beverly Kaufman is involved with the clerk's office that oversees the probate courts in Harris County. I checked the probate dockets for conflict of interest, real property sales, other links in the search engine, and I couldn't find anything. But under the section called Miscellaneous Personal Records, I clicked on there. I typed in Paula Miller, which was the trustee, and it popped up. It said Paula Miller, and it said Judge Russell Austin, which happens to be the judge in Probate 1 Court. I looked at it, and it said Campaign Finance Election Report from 2001 to 2005. I looked at it, and I went down to the clerk's office. I got these. It was just a notice of the fact that there was a campaign election report filed regarding Paula Miller and Judge Austin, but I pulled the records. And since 2001, Paula Miller has been the judge's campaign election finance treasurer. The document signed by Judge Austin and Paula Miller, which in those documents state Paula Miller is the treasurer of this judge's election campaign. I provided that to my sister, and in the meantime, I was talking to Russell Varney with Judicial Watch about this, and she provided it to him. And I believe Mr. Varney contacted Channel 13 News. Channel 13 News conducted an investigative report on this and appeared at the courthouse, and at one of the proceedings, asked Paula Miller in the hallway, "We'd appreciate if you could tell us about your relationship with Judge Austin." And Paula Miller says, "I don't have a relationship with Judge Austin." And Channel 13 News put on there, they superimposed the campaign finance reports showing her as treasurer, the judge's campaign with his signature, her signature, and her name on there over 2001 to 2005. Shortly after that, Judge Austin discharges her as trustee, temporary trustee. Then my sister informs me that the judge has taken action to strike the provision that my sister and I, as beneficiaries, can appoint a trustee and modified an irrevocable trust that my dad had established before his death. And that is my understanding currently under appeal. In the interim, my sister and I agreed, and I appointed her under a trust provision for her to be the trustee. And that is still pending in the court right now. But again, when we appointed Ms. Miller temporary trustee for 2 6-month periods, I also went back to the court record and tried to figure out what was going on. Over and above the conflict of interest with the judge and this woman as a treasurer, my sister and I signed a agreed order appointing Ms. Miller to 2 6-month terms as the temporary trustee. In there it says after the 2 6-month terms are ended that my sister and I revert back to us as co-trustees as the trust agreement specifically. Judge Austin lined through that provision shortly after it appears I signed it and said subject to further orders of his court. So basically Judge Austin struck the fact under that agreed order that we are the two co-trustees that appointed Ms. Miller under the trust agreement, and after we appointed her, that provision was struck out of the agreed order that we both signed, and all we went to the court was to file this thing. There was no proceeding, the judge had no ruling on this thing, it was an agreed order both parties, my sister and I, signed to appoint this lady to do an accounting. And then the fact that the judge has stricken the provision where my sister and I, as beneficiaries, can appoint a trustee, he has stricken that. And he did that, and that is under appeal. Under that hearing, my sister and I were waiting to hear the signature of the order striking that provision so we can begin our appeal process. At that time, we were waiting, I think, a few months. We had not gotten it to start the appeal process. Then the date that we do hear that it is signed, I believe it was May last year, I did some more research, and I found out that I was informed that Frost National Bank, which was at the time involved with Paula Miller in our trust, was appointed as the trustee. And this is still pending under appeal. During that same time, I looked at the date, and I did a search on the internet to type in Judge Russell Austin and that date. And I came up with information that on that date, there was a meeting with the Houston Bar Association Probate Section Division, in which Judge Austin was meeting with the chairman of the Houston Bar Association Probate Division. The chairman of that division is the attorney for Frost Bank. Also on that commission or committee is also Mr. Louis Ditta, who is the guardian of my mother's estate, and also one of the persons that's involved with the law firm that Paula Miller's attorney, Mr. Randall Lamb, was with. So we were waiting many months for this order. The order finally is signed, and the same day that we get it, that we find out Frost Bank is now the trustee, is the same date that the judge is meeting with the Frost Bank's attorney at this hearing, this meeting at the Houston Bar Association Probate Section. And at that meeting, also on the committee, is the guardian of my mother's estate and a person from the law firm that represents Paula Miller. And the judge, obviously with his conflict with Paula Miller, my sister mentioned about an article with the Houston Business Journal. And Houston's Business Journal, dated February 2002, Judge Austin's quoted in the document here promoting Ms. Miller. And in a pending matter before his court, and later to be found out that this woman is his campaign finance treasurer from 2001 to 2005, clearly makes me feel that the judge cannot be fair and impartial. And before you can attempt, this committee or the Senate or the people of Texas can attempt to look at oversight and assisting trust and management and keep these kind of things from happening, the first thing you have to look at is the independent and impartial right that we have as citizens of the judiciary to be fair and impartial and not have any conflicts of interest or bias, where they look strictly at the facts and the law and the matters before the court and make an opinion to protect the people and be the third checks and balances on our government as a legislature and executive branch. The federal government adopted rules for disqualification that are very simple. In their rules for disqualification of a judge, it says clearly that, and I'll quote, under United States Code Section 28, United States Code Section 455, judiciary and judicial procedure, organization of courts, general provisions applicable to courts and judges, disqualification of justice, judge, or magistrate. Any justice, judge, or magistrate, judge of the United States shall disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. This isn't a party before the court filing a motion to disqualify the judge. This isn't a judiciary committee disqualifying a judge. This is the judge himself shall disqualify himself, not may, in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. He shall also disqualify himself where he has a personal bias or prejudice concerning a party or personal knowledge of disputed evidentiary facts in the proceedings. Clearly promoting a trustee in a Houston Business article on a pending matter before his court meets this test, as well as the person being his campaign finance treasurer from 2001 to 2005. And part of the recusal statute adopted by the federal government is stated in here in a brief paragraph under an analysis under recusal under the federal court. It says, in order to resolve these issues, in 1974, Congress enacted an extensive provision of Section 455 based on the 1972 American Bar Association Code of Judicial Conduct, which was adopted with only slight modifications by the Judicial Conference in 1973 as the Code of Conduct for the United States judges. The legislature history made it clear that in revising the statute, Congress wished to remove any duty to sit, the wording in Section 455 now parallels that Canon 3C of the Code. The current version of 455 reads, and I'll be more happy to submit that to the...
We'd like to have that.
...to the thing. I've also can provide the analysis for you to look at how the federal courts and legislature has handled this matter for you to consider. But, and also under the Texas Constitution, which I'm not sure if this committee is involved with that or if it's a referendum for the public, but under the State Judicial Commission on Judicial Conduct, under their preamble of what they operate under the Texas Constitution, Article 5, Section 1A, Retirement, Censure, Removal, and Compensation of Judges. On paragraph 6, it states, any justice or judge of the courts established by this Constitution or created by the legislature as provided in Section 1, Article 4 of this Constitution may, subject to the either other provisions hereof, be removed from office for willful or persistent violations of rules promulgated by the Supreme Court of Texas, incompetence in performing the duties of the office, willful violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct, or willful or persistent conduct that is clearly inconsistent with the proper performance of his duties, or cast public discredit upon the judiciary or administration of justice. I think the matters in my case and the cases that you've heard today before this body clearly meets all of those violations. And I propose that this court, this committee, or whoever is involved, consider changing the Constitution from the word "may" to the "they shall be removed," because by strengthening these recusal provisions, where it's very simple to remove judges, it's very simple for them to say, "I'm off the case. I got a problem. I'll move it to another court." It makes the public feel more comfortable that they don't have to go through an act of Congress to remove these people and have a fair hearing of impartiality before the court. And basically what I've been hearing today in his testimony, that it looks like it is an act of Congress to have a judge removed and to have them recused and to possibly get with the Senate Commission on Judicial Conduct, because it looks like there's a big, long, drawn-out process to do that. Whereas the federal law says it's simple, that if a reasonable person feels the man cannot be impartial or woman, that they themselves have to get off the case. And under... you can bear with me just a second.
Mr. Connie, while you're looking for that, Senator Gallegos has a question.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you, and understand I'm not a lawyer or a probate or anything like that. Just, okay, you stated to this committee that when your dad... under Texas law, your dad divvied up the estate between your mom, your sister, and you. Is that correct?
You talk about before his death?
But before his death.
No, before his death, he had established a trust in which he was the trustee himself while he was living. And during that time, he sold one piece of property to my sister and I in a corporation that he established. It was one block downtown in Houston in 1982. But he—that was the only thing he had separated from the trust. Upon his death, all the remaining assets still were in the trust. Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned that he divvied up something between your mom, you, and your sister.
No, my mother, sister, and I, under the trust agreement and his will, are to be independent co-executors of his will, and we're also to be independent co-trustees of his trust.
So that means you get your part, your sister gets her part. And your mom gets her part.
No, sir. The trust is for the benefit of my mother and myself, and we serve as co-trustees, and we would agree how any benefits will be distributed to under the trust agreement. The primary taken care of is my mother, which we've done, and any other expenses or costs under that trust agreement will be unanimously agreed to by us, and then we would handle it at that point.
Okay, and then your mother became incapacitated. That's why you hired a trustee or a guarantor?
The guardian of the of my mother's estate that was established filed a motion for receivership to try to put all of our operations into a receivership. And to mitigate damages based on that threat by this gentleman, we entered into a temporary agreement to appoint this woman for 2 6-month terms to do an accounting for the trust.
And as a result of all the transactions you mentioned in your testimony, costs have incurred not only into you, but your sister's trust also.
Yes, sir. Just on two of our buildings, it's cost us about $5 million in rents that we've lost that we were trying to get done, and most of it based on the prior rents we had with Harris County. That has been gone. That income, because my attempts to lease the property to get them back on lease terms with two major brokers has been thwarted. Also, we have over $3 million in cash that has been taken out in fees and charges. So about $8 million roughly has been, we've been affected by it. Myself personally has been affected in the millions of dollars because I had properties that I'd bought for the benefit of our corporations that my dad guaranteed the note on that have been affected. And, it's just been an overall problem.
So all this cash you're talking about has been affected by the transaction that you've testified before this committee?
Yes, sir. We had $2.5 million cash in the bank when we appointed the temporary trustee. That was gone. Then they sold our building on Old Spanish Trail that was leased to the county that the trust owned for $2 million. That $2 million is gone. And now the Frost Bank is involved. They borrowed $1 million, my understanding, which I didn't know and I didn't authorize. I just found out about. They borrowed up to $1 million line of credit on our properties downtown, and $300,000 has been taken out of that. And approximately $100,000 of that $300,000 Frost Bank paid to Ms. Miller and her attorney a few months ago.
So, to finish up, Mr. Chairman, the monies that you had,
yes, sir,
you're having to borrow money to fight the case, as opposed to that dollar amount that you gave me, and now you have to borrow money to keep the case going. Is that correct?
We're not borrowing any money for any case. This is just strictly the operations within our trust, the business.
Well, that's what I'm. Well, when I say case, the trust.
Yeah, they've taken all the cash away in these exorbitant fees, and not helped us generate income that we had before. They've actually not wanted to have income because they've been trying to sell our properties, and having a tenant there would obviously encumber the properties and hold up them from being sold. So they have not been leasing the properties.
Thank you, Mr. Carter.
Just the one thing I wanted to mention, based on the federal law and the recusal motion and maybe a possible change to the Texas Constitution, there was a case in which a judge was disqualified in federal court, and it was appealed, and the appellate court ruled that the judge should have disqualified himself. And they basically stated that we understand the cost of the case. We understand that by removing the judge, that the same decision could be arised in a retrial. But we feel this is unfortunate, and there's not much we can do about it, because all the judge had to do at the beginning of all this is when he felt that a reasonable person could feel he could not be impartial, all he had to do was disqualify himself from the case. And that's all Judge Austin had to do, was disqualify himself at the beginning, because obviously he had a relationship with this person, and say, look, I'm going to go move it to an independent court, let them handle it, let them look at the facts, and if you've had them leased, and we'll release the properties, we'll generate the income, it's all unencumbered, we'll take care of you and your family like your father intended, that he worked 50 years to build up this for, and that there won't be a problem. And that's what I expected as a citizen of Texas and a native citizen. And this is not being done. And obviously, based on what Judicial Watch has talked today and the testimony of the other individuals, this is not, we're not alone. And I think as oversight of the people of the state of Texas, the Senate committee today, looking at this stuff, I think before you can look at oversight and tightening up measures involving trust, that you have to look at possibly looking at the federal law, changing what you've got to where it's very simple. That and a judge knows this, that if he drifts onto this bias or partiality, or if he makes an appearance of that, or if a reasonable person feels he can't be impartial, that he's got to get off on his own. And if he doesn't, there'll be quick, swift measures under the legislature and by the people of Texas to get him removed, where the parties can quickly and simply have a fair hearing before a court. And if the judges know that there's a swift method, that it's fair, that it'll be administered, especially if it just mirrors the federal law, which is in place, then they know that if I get that inkling, I'm going to be slammed, I'm going to be stopped. So then that inkling goes back away, anything that might cross their mind, back on the straight and narrow, and honor their obligations under the Constitution of the state of Texas.
Sounds good.
And again, I thank you for giving me the opportunity. Again, I'm here at great expense that I've incurred, and I feel it's my duty as a citizen to let you know by this, not only to protect us now and in the future, but also anybody else before the court. And I'd like to mention, my grandfather came here from Italy 100 years ago. They had nothing. He was a chief engineer of merchant ships. They never owned their own home. They moved from place to place. My grandfather was severely burned on a ship with a steam pipe blew up. They became strawberry farmers in Hammond, Louisiana, outside New Orleans. My dad started as a salesman in New Orleans with a Chevrolet dealer who was from the Motors Holding Division of General Motors, which provides investment capital. He trained my father. My father moved up to salesman. In 1957, Mike Persia, bought a dealership in downtown Houston on McKinney and San Jacinto. My father became part owner general manager with a buyout provision after 5 years from the earnings of the corporation to buy the dealership. He built the dealership up within a few years to be the second largest dealership in the United States, bought out his stock interest, and became 100% owner of the corporation. He worked hard. He trained me with integrity and duty to treat the customers fairly, to look out for them, and they'll look out for you. And then he started from there. Our first home, when my dad moved to Houston, he leased. He didn't own his own home until approximately, he started in 1957, I believe it was 1965. He finally was able to get his own home. So it affects people that are from modest means. It affects people that are from medium means. It affects people that have many means. But again, we're a classless society. We got away from that when we separated from England. Anybody that wants to work hard, they can make it. But I don't think anybody, no matter what earnings they have, whether they're modest or meager or very successful, should be treated any differently than fairly and impartially in front of the courts of the state of Texas. And obviously the federal courts have addressed that. It's an evolutionary process. They evolved this in 1974. And I think we might be under that process here in Texas. And I appreciate your looking at this, and I'm more than happy to provide these documents to you so you can review it in a later date.
It's well said, Mr. Connie, and we appreciate your testimony
Thank
today.
Thank you. I appreciate it again.
Thank you very much for being here. Are there others in the room? We don't have any other witness cards at the desk. Are there others in the room that would like to testify on charge two? Is there any more business before the committee? If not, on motion of Senator Gallegos, the committee will stand in recess, subject to the call of the chair. And I have 15 minutes to get something.